secondhand. The very term brings forth questions of quality. It also brings forth thoughts about consumption, waste, and the lure of brand new. Why do we keep buying more? And what are the marketing practices, design failures, and racial prejudices that push used items into landfills? What do we need to change to build a sustainable future? Hello, I'm Gina Murphy Darling, and this is Down to Earth. As people who know me can attest to, including one of our guests today sitting right here next to me, I am honestly wild and crazy about resale. I'm proud to let people know that I'm wearing a brand name dress, which I purchased for a fraction of the cost. I'm the queen of spreading the message, shop resale, not retail. Needless to say, I'm excited about this show on many levels. And perhaps the most important reasons is because the guests that we're going to have with my friend Judy made me think deeper, more deeply about resale, made me stop to contemplate adding some very important thoughts to my shopping behavior, even though I'm proud I say shop resale, not retail, that are really well worth contemplating. It's going to be yet another fun, exciting, and impactful show, so I'm glad that everybody is here with me. Our guests today are Judith Roman Bukakis, Director of Marketing at Goodwill Industries of Southern Arizona, and Adam Minter. Adam is an American writer who serves as an Asia-based columnist at Bloomberg View. In addition to his work with Bloomberg, Adam covers a range of topics for publications that have included Bloomberg Businessweek, Smithsonian, The Wall Street Journal, Time, The Los Angeles Times, National Geographic, The Atlantic, Foreign Policy, The National Interest, Mother Jones, Scientific American, Art News, Sierra, and many others. And I am thrilled to have both of you with us. And Adam, I say that long list as kind of an introduction so that our guests get a sense for the work you've been doing and the impact you've been having. And it's exciting for me to see where you're getting published and the kind of things you're writing about. So thanks for joining us from Minnesota, I think it is today, right?
Yes, it's Minnesota. And really, the pleasure's all mine. I'm honored to be here.
It's going to be fun. So let's start with this. I just got back from a really fun an impactful conference a couple of weeks ago in Washington, D.C. called Planet Forward. And it's students and faculty from all over the country and some international visitors. It's based at George Washington University. It's a really fun conference that's focused on students and training them to tell their stories in ways that will help move the planet forward. Like, what a clever, this guy, Frank says, no, he worked for CNN and he's got them. And it's all about telling stories. And certainly in the 10 years I've been doing this, people like stories. They rather, if you say, well, this is my opinion, they'd much rather hear a story. It's benign, it's non-threatening. And it's just easier. It's the thing of the day. How do you tell your story? So before we get on the, what I call the detail path, and you know, you've written two books, Junkyard Planet, and The Second Hand is coming out on November 12th, which we'll talk more about. If I met you at a conference or saw you online at a restaurant and I talked to everybody, I'd say, so Adam, what's your story? How did you get started on this path? Because that's where I'd like to start.
Sure. Well, I was born into it. I mean, I like to tell people I was born in a junkyard, which is almost true, because I actually come from a recycling family, a scrap metal recycling family, dating back to my great-grandfather, who was an immigrant scrap peddler on the streets of Galveston, Texas. He came from Russia, had no education, no English, and he wanted to go into vaudeville, but if you don't have English and education or know how to dance, you're not going to have a real
tough.
Yeah. So he did what you see people do in developing economies everywhere, which was what the U.S. was at the time. And he started picking rags and other recyclable things off the streets and eventually made his way to Minnesota and had a small scrapyard. And it was passed down and my father worked in it. And I grew up working in it very closely with my grandmother, who was very important to me. And so, I mean, really, from my, you know, my earliest memories are spending time, you know, as a toddler, even in a junkyard, which is something that not many people can actually say, or at least not many writers can. And so I grew up, you could say, with a recycling ethic, although I very much looked at it, you know, as a business, even from the earliest age. And, you know, I have lots of memories of not just being in the junkyard, but also going with my grandmother to garage sales and to thrift shops. And it was just, it was all a part of our life. And for a lot of reasons, which I describe in Junkyard Planet, I didn't go into the business. But one of the things that I found in my years traveling in the junk world, if you will, is that if somebody works in the field for more than about 6 weeks, they're always going to circle back to it. So in my early 20s, when I, you know, decided I was going to write and work as a journalist, I thought that was it. But pretty quickly, I found myself circling back and reporting on recycling. And I had moved to China to be a foreign correspondent. And at the time, as we all know, in the early 2000s, China started buying incredible amounts of recycling from the United States.
Right.
And so I was there to document that. It was just pure dumb luck. But it was providential.
Yeah,
there you
We're
go.
We're shaking our heads. No, it was really on purpose, because look what happened.
Yeah.
We're not buying that.
Well, luck or providential, whatever it was, I was there, and I was somebody with a background. And one of the things about the recycling industry in particular is it's very closed and even a little secretive. It's a little bit of a black box, especially in developing countries. But because I'd come from the industry, I could go to, you know, a Chinese scrap metal dealer and who would be very suspicious of a journalist walking in, but I could kind of I could kind of talk the talk and walk the walk, and you know, it's a brotherhood, it's a sisterhood. You know, people who grew up around it or who do it, you know, we kind of I feel a real kinship to them. And because of that, it opened doors, and I was able to document this amazing moment, especially in the 2000s, when there was all this recycling moving into China. And that's that grew into the first book, Junkyard Planet, and has sort of given birth in the last chapter in Junkyard Planet to some of the themes that we found I've drawn out in a secondhand.
So I cannot wait to talk more about that. And I cannot help but say this. My husband's grandfather owned a junkyard, and the joy that he got, everything you were saying, being with his grandpa,
yeah,
going in the junkyard as a kid and having it be such a safe place, and I can say this without hesitation, that never leaves your blood, because this man, he trolls secondhand stores.
Oh, yeah.
And not only that, Adam, what I found, my mother... We shopped in thrift stores. We absolutely did. But my mother had an eye, and it was mostly fashion. It was mostly our clothes, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Back in a day when it was not politically correct to tell people you got this at the thrift store in, you know, Red Bank, New Jersey, right? But what James can do, you talk about separating, what is that expression, the wheat from the chaff?
Yeah.
Yeah, something like that. He finds the hidden treasures. He finds the diamond in the rough. And I'm like, what are you doing with that? And he says, I'm going to make this out of it. So that is in your blood. And I just had to do a high five to you and to my husband, because it's fascinating. He's making lamps right now out of a bunch of missing pieces. It's like, what are you doing?
Oh, I know what he's doing.
Yes, you do know what he's doing. So here's what I want to try and get to with this book.
Sure.
First of all, why did you write it? It's hard to write a book. And you know it. I wrote one book. I want to write another book. You're busy. I think I read that you're married. I'm not sure. It doesn't matter. But you have a busy life. You travel.
Sure.
What in God's name got you motivated enough to write another book? And this is a tough subject. So tell us about how you came to that decision. Like, I just have another one in me, and it's got to get out there.
Yeah, it was a couple of things, really. After I wrote Junkyard Planet, I started getting a lot of emails and a couple of letters from readers, and they wanted to share with me how they recycle. It was a book about recycling. But one of the things that struck me from those letters was they were all telling me about upcycling and reuse. You know, at home, we'll fix our computers or try and use parts from an old one to make a new one.
Right.
There's all kinds of different upcycling things. They would invite me to their thrift shops. Nobody was talking to me about the giant automobile shredders that I wrote about in Junkyard Planet or any of that. They were telling me about reuse, and that started, you know, sort of fixing in my mind. And I thought, you know, maybe I should do something for them at some point. But that wasn't enough. What really clinched it was actually only a couple weeks after Junkyard Planet was published, my mother passed away. And like so many Americans and actually people around the world, one of the things you're faced with after the loss of a relative is you need to find out, you need to figure out what to do with all of their property.
The stuff.
And, you know, and my sister and I were faced with that. And I was living in Shanghai at the time. She lives in a New York City co-op with her husband. We didn't have room for everything, you know.
Couldn't put it on the estate or in the junkyard.
Right. And you know, and so, you know, it's a painful process. I mean, every I think, you know, it's almost becoming, you know, as much a rite of passage as the funeral itself, not to be morbid about it.
And totally so, agree with you. I totally get it.
You know, and so, you know, we selected some things to keep, but the rest of it, we just didn't know what to do. And so we did what so many people do. And we said, well, I guess we'll give it to Goodwill. And, you know, amongst the things that we gave to Goodwill was a set of dishes that belonged to her. And I remember as I dropped them off at the donation door at a Goodwill in Hopkins, Minnesota, I remember thinking, I wonder what's going to happen to this.
Those dishes, yes.
Yeah. And I always, you know, I always assumed it's reused because in the recycling industry, if you drop something off at a junkyard or recycling operation, they are going to find the best use for it insofar as the best use is, you know, there's somebody willing to pay for it to make it into raw materials.
Right.
And it occurred to me that after all these years of being around the recycling industry, with my grandmother going to thrift shops, I really didn't know the process of what happens to those dishes or what happened to some of the clothes. And so that began a conversation with my wife. And, you know, I had connections in secondhand retail, you know, overseas in Malaysia. I knew some stuff about Japan, but I really didn't know the outlines, to be honest with you, of what goes on in the American thrift market. So that was the start of it. And I talked to my agent and we talked to my publisher, Bloomsbury, and they said, well, see if you can put together, you know, a short proposal. And I did. And that was really the birth of it. So it wasn't necessarily a clean, you know, origin. I have this idea, we're going
to
do this.
Right. It was not from point A to point B. It was a circuitous route.
Yeah, it was. And it was an emotional route as well. I mean, for me, in many ways, it's a very personal book.
The things that come up for me would crack you up. There was a place in the White Mountains where we used to go. It's a collectibles thrift store. And Adam, I kid you not, it had to be 15 years ago. There was a set of dishes there that I thought, this is somebody's dishes. Don't even ask me how many sets of dishes I have because it's a disgrace to say on air. Not as many as my best friend, but I don't want any more dishes. And do you know what, Adam? You're right about the nostalgic part, about the emotional part. I remember those dishes and there's a piece of me that wishes I had gotten them because I love them. So it's if you're into this and you connect with what the whole package is, I can really and truly relate to everything you're saying. It's a very special thing. So two questions.
Sure.
Give us the Reader's Digest about the book, which is coming out in November. And then let's get into one of the things, like I said, struck me in the intro is the crisis of quality. Because there are big eye-openers that have come to my across my path just in the past couple of weeks. So give us the big picture of what the book is about.
Well, it really starts from at the donation door, if you will, and looking at what is, you know, the steady flow of stuff from our homes into the thrift system, the secondhand system, and much of that is represented by Goodwill in the book. You know, I wanted to first show just how much is moving into the system, and then kind of what happens to it, both in the United States, and I also show you what happens because there's a similar process in Japan. I wanted it to not just be focused on the United States. And then we follow the stuff through the system, not only through the thrift stores, but not everything can be sold in a thrift store. You know, some of it ends up being exported overseas. Some of it ends up being, you know, in Arizona, there in southern Arizona, there's a brisk trade of used things that move south into Mexico and in Central America. So I look at that and, you know, I show readers what's happening. And of course, you can't show the full scope of, you know, the world of secondhand retail any more than you can show the full scope of, you know, new retail. But I try and give portraits so people get a piece of it and see that, you know, there's these wonderful innovations and what an extraordinary thing that Goodwill does. You know, it's not just opening a store and stuff comes in and stuff goes out. I mean, there's an enormous amount that goes into what Goodwill does and what makes it successful and such an important community resource, not just for, you know, the jobs training programs that it puts together, but how it handles our stuff. You know, nobody else could really do that without the scale of expertise that they have. And then the last third or to a quarter of the book is really more prescriptive. After we've seen everything and where everything goes, and some of what the limits are. I mean, at a certain point, you know, there is an end to everything. You can't wear a garment forever, and it can only go through the thrifting system so many times. You know, I start to look at how we can maybe improve the fortunes of thrift. You know, the thrift stores are doing great. Goodwill is doing great. And this sort of elides with your second question. But there's so much stuff now. You know, what can we do to help Goodwill, other thrift stores, other secondhand businesses and nonprofits do even more and be more successful and create a more secondhand world? How can we promote it? And that's where I get into what you just mentioned. You know, we don't really have, in my estimation, a crisis of quantity. There's too much stuff. You know, of course, if you spend time at a Goodwill donation door, and I spent, as Judith knows, quite a bit of time, you might start to think we have a real crisis of quantity. I mean, you know, probably Judith doesn't want me to say this, but I think everybody in their life should spend a day at a Goodwill donation door watching what's coming in. Call Judith. She'll set you up.
I do things like that with her.
but it's amazing. And it's both. It's exciting. It's also a little bit demoralizing because you start to see, my goodness, we have so much stuff. But
it's like Christmas every day.
Exactly.
And she calls me occasionally with good finds.
Right. There you go. But there's so much stuff, and it's easy to think, oh, we just have too much stuff and it can't be all handled. To some extent, that's true. But one of the things I found, whether spending time with folks at Goodwill or, you know, I spent time in West Africa at clothing sorting operations there. You know, West Africa imports, you know, enormous tonnages of clothing from around the world, developed countries. And in each case, you know, if you talk to the people who sort the clothes, they're saying the same thing, is that they're not as well made as they were made a couple years ago. Right. That we're seeing a decline in quality. And if the clothes aren't as well made, you can't keep reselling them. You know, and the same goes for furniture. I don't want, you know, flat pack furniture. I'll take a shot at IKEA. You know, IKEA is a good example. It's really hard to move your IKEA furniture, much less move it to a Goodwill, have the Goodwill put it on the floor, then somebody move it out without it cracking. And so that, to me, is a problem from a secondhand industry standpoint, because then it can't be resold and sold and sold over and over again. It can maybe be resold once. And so from my point of view, you know, the biggest challenge, the biggest problem is how do we deal with this crisis of quality? Because if we have better quality stuff, it can withstand the secondhand industry. It can withstand the thrift industry. It can be used and reused. And so that's sort of what I mean by this crisis of quality rather than a crisis of quantity. And I think that's the problem, if we want to call it a problem, that needs to be solved and can really help not just Goodwill, but the thrifting industry thrive and grow.
Such a great, great explanation. And I describe my brain now to people. I say that things like, I point to my head and I say, this just in, because so many things just came in with what you were saying. And I'm really, really listening. And the whole IKEA conversation, we could go off and do another show about that. On the one hand, they do everything to minimize their waste. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, my husband would never consider under any circumstances buying a piece of IKEA furniture for the reasons that you said, because he likes quality. And then on the other hand, the third bulletin that just came in is there's always the, I can't afford really good furniture. And to me, as many times as I can reiterate on this show, that's why you should go to places that sell used furniture, because you can buy really, really good used furniture in secondhand stores. Like, antiques, treasures, things that you can find. And if you want a piece that you're going to pass on to your children and grandchildren, which we have in this family, think about the investment. People don't. They think it's cheap, right, and that's what I can afford right now. And I admit, getting that dresser that you have a visual for might take you 4 or 5 months more than just going online and ordering something cheap and crappy at IKEA. And I don't want to trash them. They are what they are. But they're so symptomatic of what's wrong. So I think it's great that you brought them up. And it's just something that we need to think about, that's so in alignment with what your message is when you travel to new global garage sale. The other thing I just have to say, and I promise we'll move on, is James and I do go to garage sales, and I can't believe the crap that people sell, that they try to sell. It's offensive. Yeah. It's like half-burned candles, $3, and socks with holes in them, $2. And James and I will look at each other and say, what are these people doing? I wouldn't even donate that to Goodwill. So that's another thought. It goes back to what is the first R. So talk a little bit more, if you have anything else to add, about the crisis of quality and how is that affecting the secondhand industry? How does it tie into the idea of global sustainability? Quality.
Well, you know, what it does, it's ironic. I mean, if we just talk about clothing, for example, and the fast fashion phenomenon, on the front end, you know, we all know it saves everybody money. I mean, if we're just looking at the cost of acquisition, it's very cheap. You know, you can go to, I mean, since we're naming brands, whatever, you know, we could go to a Forever 21 and
We were talking about that before you came on the air. If you want to buy something that might not even last three wears, go there.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. But the problem is that, you know, when it gets into the thrifting system, the costs start moving up. I mean, nothing is for free. So let me give you an example. If you talk to folks at the Goodwill Outlet Center on Irvington Road there in Tucson, some of the buyers there who make their living by going through the clothes there, they say it because, you know, the decline in quality over the last couple of years, it takes them more time to get the same amount of clothes that they can resell in Mexico that it did, you know, a couple of years ago, just because the quality of what's being put out there, it's just not what it used to be.
And so, the handling and the time costs
money.
Yes. Exactly.
To do the good thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because Goodwill, I mean, one of the most extraordinary things about Goodwill for me is the incredible professionalism and expertise of the Goodwill employees whose job it is to sort the donations, especially the clothing, as it comes in. It's funny, like they're doing this thing at Goodwill, and I remember talking to somebody who was sorting jewelry. There's also jewelry sorters. I said, do you know of anybody else who has your job or level of expertise? And her name's Melinda. And she just smiled and says, I don't think so. You know, it's really extraordinary. But it's an extraordinary expertise. But it costs money. And so as the quality of stuff goes down, it costs an organization like Goodwill money in terms of employees and you know, having to develop people who can do this, which is great, they have this, but the costs are there. And it gets passed on then to the traders who like to take these, if for instance, off Irvington Road, a lot of that stuff moves south of the border. It also raises the price for them. And that means if you're raising the price for them, less stuff is getting recycled. So, I mean, it echoes in so many ways, and it's not just a clothing thing. I mean, it reflects on all kinds of goods that might otherwise be made better.
So many. The disposable, we live in just a disposable world. For over 114 years and 50 years in Southern Arizona, Goodwill has really gotten to know their stuff and have an incredible expertise about anything for resale and donating. So Judy, what do you say? Do you want to elaborate on the crisis of quality at Goodwill? It takes more time and money. And I, until this show, I told you, I was really excited about the show, and you and I have done a lot. And one of the reasons was, I always like it when it's something I didn't think about. Mm-hmm. So you have donations, I see those boxes.
Yeah.
There's another layer.
There is. And you know, we're always very thankful of the generous donations we get, because we do get the valuable hardwood furniture.
Great thing to say.
Collectibles, artwork, well-made clothing, and that's why people shop with us. But we're also seeing an influx of that trendy fast fashion pieces coming in too, which is also why people shop with us. But, you know, those items that are cheaply made don't last very long, like we had mentioned before. And of all the donations we get, we sometimes get items that are not high quality. So they're already broken, or clothing that's, you know, the stitching is already unraveling. And so what we try to do with our folks who are trained, you know, we sort through the stuff. Is it something, you know, one, we can sell? And two, is it going to offer value not only to Goodwill as revenue so we could support our mission, but also to the shopper? And, you know, Goodwill of Southern Arizona, not all Goodwills do this. So we price on a good, better, best quality pricing structure. And we have, you know, we train our staff to do that. But you know, not all things are created equal, right? So the lower quality items are obviously priced at a lower price point, and then the higher quality items a little bit more. And so we have this consumer culture, though, that, you know, because they can buy something so cheaply, it's really starting to affect the value that they put on a higher quality item.
Got it. So they don't want to pay a little bit more because they're right. Like, why is that so expensive at Goodwill?
Exactly. I mean, to some people, you know, a shirt is a shirt is a shirt. Why am I paying more for this shirt than the other shirt? But, you know, they just, but you're considering, you know, what that longevity of that item is, and that is really where the value is. And you know, we field questions all the time about, you know, pricing and things like that, and we have to explain to them this is why. And so when the idea of what quality is affects how people buy, it really does affect Goodwill. And the other tough part about quality is that, you know, we say we have non-sellable clothing or broken furniture that can't be restored by a youth restoration project. I mean, we have to incur the cost of throwing those things out.
Getting rid of it. Yes.
And, you know, if there aren't any avenues of recycling or things like that, we actually have to pay to take those to the landfill, which is not something that we like to say, but that's the reality of it. And, you know, these are dollars that would have otherwise been invested in our employees or adult and youth programs. And so that's where that crisis of quality really affects us.
And people don't really take the time to hear what I call the backstory. That's mm-hmm. a big, important backstory. So all those steps impact the price of the item because mm-hmm. you have to figure that in or you'll be out of business. Nonprofit doesn't mean don't have a profit because that means let's close the doors. So all of those cost factors have to be in. And I just have to, because I forget, how long does one item stay in a sorter's hands? You told me that. How long does it take for them to size it like a piece of clothing?
Gosh.
I think you told me.
I don't know, seconds, really.
That's what you said.
Yeah.
it's seconds. Adam, yeah, right? It's they have to have the eye, the trained eye, and it's got to move. It's got to move.
And let me just say, not just the eye, but also the feel. That was something that was really a bit of a revelation to me. Is they will tend to wear gloves, the sorters, the clothing sorters, because you might have pins and other things that can poke them. But one of the things you'll see is the professionalism of the sorter is really great. But if there's something they're just not sure about, what they'll always do is they'll take off the glove and feel the fabric. And on the basis of how the fabric feels, they can tell the quality, and then it can be sorted into the correct place. But that feel is really important too, because it tells you, you know, sometimes you can't tell by the look of the garment. You really have mm-hmm. to feel the quality of that garment, and they will do that. But yeah, to your point, it's a few seconds. I think it's very rare you'd see anybody hold anything longer than maybe 10, 15 seconds.
Yeah. And I had a master trainer, my mother. She would do things like unzip it and say, see this zipper, how this works, and see the lining, and see how this hem is finished. Well, that's learned behavior. And I taught my children, and then, boy, one of my daughters took it to another level because she knows every good label that's out there. And when we go Goodwill shopping or secondhand shopping, she's like, Mom, try this on. This is a really good label. It's going to last. Okay. Jude, you mm-hmm. talked about, before we got on air, you were really excited about doing the show. And so was I. You were excited about the book.
Me too.
I knew it was going to be a fun love fest. What got you so excited? What did you want people to learn, not just about the book, but about Goodwill's part in it?
Well, I mean, the book is called Secondhand, right? And Goodwill's been in the business for over 114
travels
years.
Travels in the global
so
garage.
So I think we had a little bit of expertise that we could provide Adam, but
yes.
But we were really grateful, actually, for someone who was interested in learning the inner workings of Goodwill, and then, you know, because we're more than just a thrift store and donation centers. And when we were first approached, one of the things that we wanted Adam to understand was why we even had this business model and why we did what we do. And this is our mission, you know, in our community. And he was open to learning all of it. And that was kind of the way that, you know, I really kind of had to sell it to our senior team. It's like, hey, there's somebody that wants to know. He wants to write a book, and, you know, we're going to be in it. And so
be transparent and let him in or not.
Yeah, and and it's important for us to, you know, communicate openly and honestly about the reality of the business. But then but this is why, you know, our mission is why we do these things. And you know, he was able to spend a lot of time with some of our mission programs. And it, he really gave us the platform to talk about, you know, the processing, the people management, the logistics, the how we compete in the retail environment, and, you know, how, you know, us as a nonprofit, because a lot of nonprofits do rely solely on third-party funding, is that we can actually fund, because when funding goes away, and it sometimes does, we can fund the programs that are most effective so that, that there's consistency of service, and we should really be proud of that as Goodwill.
As Goodwill. How did he find you?
I think
cold email.
There's lots of Goodwills.
I think was it a YouTube video of our outlet? I can't recall.
Yeah, I saw the YouTube. You know, so I found you. I was very interested in spending time at a Goodwill that was close to the border because I was interested on a lot because I'm a Bloomberg reporter. I'm very interested in global trade as well and cross border trade, and I know that that's a very important part of, you know, the secondhand trade, you know, whether it be in South Texas, you know, Southern New Mexico, Southern Arizona, and so I contacted a few different Goodwills, but I really connected well. It just felt right, you know, and I had a friend who'd told me about, you know, the brisk thrift trade in Southern Arizona. He says, you really should look at Tucson. There's a guy who's actually in the book. His name's Robin Ingenthron. You'll learn all about him, Judith.
Okay.
I felt good about our emails, and I saw the video because I had known about outlets before, but I saw a video of the outlet, and the outlet really speaks to that trade because I was very interested in that, you know, how secondhand, you know, not only benefits within a community, but it can benefit people far away from that community as well.
What happens next?
Yeah. And so I've been reporting a long time, and sometimes you just know when something feels right. And I'm so glad, you know, it worked. I mean, it couldn't have been better. It was a perfect size Goodwill organization. There are some that are bigger. There are some that are smaller. And as Judith knows, I came back a second time. You know, I did a first visit of, I think it was about 10, 11 days. And then I came back, a few months later, for, you know, another 3 or 4 days to just make sure I got everything.
I'm just going to go on record as saying I am officially mad at her because I did not get to meet you, and I don't live that far away, and we find ways to get together, but maybe there'll be a next time. Maybe we can plan a really good book signing for you to come here, and I'll get
to meet you
in person, because this is pretty exciting to me.
So, can I touch on just two things?
Absolutely.
One thing that I loved, there was a term that was used, it was on my first day there, and I just loved it because it explained so much. Is the co-presidents of the Goodwill there? They both used the term with me, the economic engine. You know, and that the secondhand, the thrift store is the economic engine that drives the social service programs that Goodwill does and these wonderful jobs training programs and the youth restoration program. And, you know, the 1,300 job placements that they did, I guess that would have been in 2017. This is off the top of my head, so Judith might credit. But I love that term economic engine because it tells you so much about how they think about how Goodwill thinks about what it does.
Yes.
You know,
yes.
there is a point to, you know, these thrift stores, and they're an engine that drives this wonderful social service program. And she used a term, and you may laugh at me, this is the business reporter and me getting excited as well. but
we love it.
Yeah, the term logistics. And one of the things that I was really excited about as I learned about at Goodwill were the complicated logistics of what it does and the genius of the logistics. One of the great challenges in secondhand, whether it's a Goodwill in Southern Arizona or, you know, a clothing sorting operation in Benin in West Africa, is getting the stuff from the people who have it to the people who want it. That's non-trivial. And in my experience, so much good secondhand stuff that could be bought simply isn't because you can't get it to the right people. And I think one of the really interesting things that I had no idea Goodwill did is they really think about where they place their stores and their donation centers in terms of, okay, this is an area where there's probably going to be a lot of donations. And they run trucks as well. And a store that doesn't get a lot of donations could call up and say, we need a load of wares, which is a catch-all term for durable goods.
Right.
And that that trucking can happen. And, you know, there's a wonderful guy, lovely guy, you know, at the headquarters there, Eric Schmidt, who's, I think of him as this mastermind with, you know, sort of.
I'm going to tell him love that.
Yeah. You know, but he's the one who makes sure things go from point A to point B and get to, you know, where there is the stuff to where there isn't the stuff. And what's interesting to me about that is I think a lot of people think of the thrifting industry as something they can do at home. You know, well, I can reuse, I can upcycle, and you certainly can and you should. But there are certain things you just can't do at home. And one is move the stuff like Goodwill does. It's an incredible public asset. And, you know, I sometimes think people forget that. But it, you know, if there wasn't a Goodwill, you know, in Southern Arizona or in other communities, you'd want to invent it to do those kinds of things it does.
When you think about retail, I mean, such a good point, and the complications of just retail and brand new things, that machine is daunting. When you add the factor of resale and that you're trying to showcase it, merchandise it, placement on the floor, adding the value, it just shuts me down. So I'll never be in that end of the business, just trust me. I'm the consumer end.
Yeah, the retail business is incredible. I actually pulled it up on my computer because it's such a great quote. If you don't mind, I'm just going to read it.
No, I don't mind.
It's in the book. And it's from Kevin Cunningham. He's the director of retail operations. And we were in a store, and he wanted to impress upon me that this is harder than doing new retail. And so I'm just going to read you the quote he gave me. And it went into my notebook, and it went into the book. So I'm going to read this to you. Yeah. Think of it as Walmart headquarters calling a Walmart store manager and saying, "You've got a truck of product coming." The manager's like, "Okay, yeah, I know." And the manager in HQ is like, "And oh, by the way, we don't know what's in that truck. No one thing in that truck is the same as any other one thing. And oh, by the way, you need to price all of it. And oh, by the way, you definitely need to make a profit selling it."
That sums it up, isn't it? That's the whole story in a couple of
sentences. And that totally sounds like Kevin. I love it.
Yeah.
We should really plan a book signing at Goodwill and hype it up and celebrate.
We would love that.
That
yes.
would, yeah. And I will, Mrs. Green will be in the house with hopefully my own autographed copy. We are coming to a close. Is there anything else? I mean, I always get the last word because it's my show and I actually love that. And I love to say that because who doesn't want the last word? But the Goodwill is all about their triple bottom line, people, planet, pocketbook. Your book is coming out November 12th. I encourage people, if they can't go to a local bookstore, which it would be my first choice, that is all about investing in a local economy. You can reserve your copy on Amazon, and I encourage you to do that. The name of the book is Secondhand, Travels in the Global Garage Sale, and it's by Adam Minter. And I don't know about you two, but this was delightful to me, and it seemed like it was about 5 minutes. So
I know it went by so fast.
I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did. And here are my last words before I promote. Our last show for June is a guy named David. Man, I'm going to have to call him up. It's like Mizujewski, a TV personality, naturalist, and author of Attracting Birds, Butterflies, and Other Backyard Wildlife. He's written an amazing book about creating habitats for pollinators, basically, a lot of that. And then we're going to be, over the next few weeks, spotlighting some of our greatest hits so we enjoy some of our summertime with family and friends. So, Adam, thank you so much. And here's my last words. As a mission-based organization, we are committed to raising awareness about every aspect of climate change imaginable. Consumerism is, without question, at the core of where we are today. We buy lots, we overpackage lots, we ship lots, and we frequently forget that the first R in the reduce, reuse, recycle chain is reduce. Adam Minter took a very thorough and courageous look at a very good practice, shopping resale. Given that the fashion industry is one of the most harmful to our planet, it's a journey worth taking. What I would like to leave you with is an uplifting message to take away. Get into resale. Be proud of it. Celebrate it. Learn about quality and be intentional with what you buy. And most importantly, have fun, because it is, and support organizations like Goodwill Industries of Southern Arizona, who are working really hard every day to make a difference for the planet in every way they know how, and continue to look for new and exciting ways, a constantly changing and sometimes fickle market. We are very proud of our partnership with them, and we do our part to help create brand awareness and identity with them as true leaders in sustainability in an industry that can present many challenges that sometimes require complex solutions, but that always have at their foundation a desire to make good things happen. Thanks for being part of our world. And thanks to the two of you. What is that they say about if you love it this much, you can't possibly call it work or
right.
a job?
Exactly.
This does not feel like work at all. So Adam, I look forward to meeting you. Thanks.
Absolutely.
I look forward to reading your book. And Judy,
thanks
for bringing him into my world.
Of course. This has been fun. I can't wait.
This has been great. Thanks, Judy.